From Charlotte, North Carolina, you're listening to the Best of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff, president of the Christian Research Institute. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank's guest is cold case homicide detective J. Warner Wallace, author of Cold Case Christianity and God's Crime Scene. Here now is Hank Hanegraaff.
And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that takes me out of the studio and into the study where I have these laid-back conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, inspirational people, well, on the planet. And today is no exception. Today I have an opportunity to talk to J. Warner Wallace. He's a cold case homicide detective. He's now a best-selling author as well. And what's interesting about J. Warner is that he was a very vocal atheist until he was 35 years of age. Sort of reminds me of myself. I was a practical atheist as well until I was 29. But then he started taking a serious and expansive look at the evidence for the Christian worldview, and he determined that Christianity was not just true, but demonstrably true. J. Warner is now an author of such books as Cold Case Christianity, God's Crime Scene, Forensic Faith. J. Warner Wallace, as always, a welcome guest on the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Hi, Jim.
So glad to be with you. I think you know how much you mean to me and my own journey out of atheism, so I'm just glad to be part of anything you're doing.
I remember you telling that story on the Bible Answer Man broadcast, and quite frankly, I was stunned to hear that you were doing investigative work. You were, investigating robberies or something like that, sitting in your police car listening to the Bible Answer Man broadcast.
Yeah, you know, I was actually working undercover at the time I became a Christian, and it's a four-year assignment. Basically, what we're doing is we are in a plainclothes position in undercover cars. My hair was really long. I think I had a beard or a goatee at the time, and we were following bank robbers or anybody who was doing crimes in our city. We would get an idea. Someone would say, I think it's so-and-so, and we would go find so-and-so, and then we would sit on him for a week and see if he did anything, and sure enough, most of the time, the informants were right. And so I was sitting in a surveillance position, and I was in a car maybe 10, 12 hours a day. You know, just wherever the bad guy goes, that's where we have to go, and he doesn't know we're following him. And so that's where I was when I first tuned into your show, and I was just struggling to figure out, well, number one, was there anybody else out there who took a reasonable evidential approach, could answer the questions, not just from a position of, well, I believe it, so therefore it's true, but could actually give me good reasons to why this was true. And that's when I found your show. And I was, you know, listen, that was at 3 o'clock every day, 5 days a week on KKLA in Los Angeles. And I remember just making sure wherever I was, hopefully nothing was happening at 3 o'clock. And I could sit and listen for that whole hour. And it became a regular part of my intellectual diet. And that's why I think it played such a huge role for me, both in terms of information, but honestly, Hank, it was just in terms of example. In other words, that there was somebody out there who took an approach that I could resonate with. And that was because I didn't know anybody like that in my personal life. The Christians that I knew were not very thoughtful about why they were Christians, if I'm honest with you. And so I found somebody in you, and on the radio every day, it was just great.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm wondering what it is like for you as someone who was so involved in police work to see people like Colin Kaepernick wearing socks that display police officers as pigs. I mean, this stereotypical idea that people have that police officers are racist, they're brutal, they're people of low character. How does that square with what you knew?
Well, I can tell you that this is a topic that is very near and dear to my heart because I came out of the arts before. I was an illustrator and a designer and then an architect before I became a police officer. So that's a very different world. But my father was a police officer my entire life, and so I knew the work and I was familiar with the work. And now my son is doing the same work. work with the same name at the same agency. So we've been there for 58 years doing this work. And I have seen the progression over time. And I will tell you that there's some takeaways I have on this, because I do think we are at a point right now in culture where we are utterly divided over this issue of police and race. And there's something that you and I as Christians could actually do about it. But we'd have to be able to bridge the gap that divides us. And so that, to me, offers an analogy that we can move forward with. It's about crossing a bridge toward each other. Yes, there will be people on both sides who will point fingers and make outrageous claims about both sides. But that's not where I'm going to be, because I will tell you this. We've got reason. Law enforcement has a number of examples over the last 5 or 6 years that have been captured on video in which law enforcement officers are caught doing something they shouldn't do. That's just the way it is. But we've got to be able to deal with that in a way that's intellectual and rational. And they don't necessarily, I would argue, that they do not represent any of the majority. In fact, they are a dramatically small minority in this work. But I'll tell you this, no one is more upset about bad police behavior than good cops. No one's more upset about it. You think that the other side's upset? You kidding? I mean, cops who see this are the ones who are the most upset, because we don't want our good name sullied when someone occasionally does something they shouldn't do. Now, I will say this. Every time you engage someone in the field as a police officer, you have a dilemma you face, especially if it's a critical situation where you're going to have to use force. And you don't want to. Nobody wants to use force. We try to keep those people out of law enforcement. But are there racists in law enforcement? Of course. There are racists in every single field. We put a pretty strong protocol in place that we hope sorts out people with racist tendencies, but people can lie. And then they sometimes get in. And so, yes, are there racist doctors? Yeah. Are there racist firemen? Yeah. Are there racist police officers? Yeah. What percentage do you think they are, though? Do we think we have a systemic problem? I don't think we have a systemic problem. I think there are bad apples in every barrel of apples, and we've got to figure out where the bad apples are. And then, of course, nobody hates the bad apple as much as the good apples. So we want that kind of thing purged, okay? There's no doubt about it. And that's the first step, I would say. But remember this, though, Hank. If we're going to cross a bridge, there are some rules and some truths about bridge crossing. And the most important rule about bridge crossing is that no one crosses a bridge without taking a step toward the middle. You think you can stay on the edge, wherever you are, and not? If you want to cross that bridge, you're going to have to step away from your position on that edge and toward the bridge and toward the other side. And both sides of this argument, if they want to cross a bridge toward each other, are going to have to take a step toward the middle, and that means you're going to have to leave something behind.
I love it. I love it. That is so well said. You're mentioning in that explanation that you're an illustrator, that you are involved in architectural work, that this is a proclivity. And as I look through your books, that's very, very obvious because you do your own illustrations. Talk about how these illustrations help people who are trying to work through very significant apologetic issues, help them grasp the concept.
Yeah, I think we are a visual culture, and whether we like it or not, we have a new language that we speak, and it's been driven by that glowing rectangle at the end of our arms, you know, that smartphone. The smartphone has, for the most part, changed the way we do business. The next generation coming up, Gen Z, these are usually typically described by the number of different descriptors, but the one that always comes out in first place is that they are digital natives. We, you and I, are digital immigrants. We came to this late. We didn't have this growing up, but they were born in that country where there were already smartphones. There was already digital technology, and really what drives digital technology is visual. So if you were going to upgrade your phone, you're probably only upgrading it, not because you got a new phone that has a much better operating system. And I can't tell the operating difference, really. But what I do notice is the screen's different, and the size of the screen is different, and the resolution of the screen is different. Even though the sound is the same, it operates the same. Why do we upgrade phones? Because of the screens. And this tells me that the primacy of visual media. As a matter of fact, this now, I think, has become a language that I call visualish. In other words, instead of speaking English to Gen Z, the next generation coming up, I'm determined to speak to them visually, which means that when I start crafting an idea for a message or an idea for a book, I don't craft it with words. I sit down with Photoshop usually and just sit down with all the possibilities visually. And I start to think, well, okay, so we're going to cross this bridge toward each other. Okay, so let's talk about the bridge as an analogy, because that's a very visual analogy. And then I can start thinking about how that's going to pan out in terms of language. So it's not that the language drives the visual, it's that the visual drives the language, and that's what I think we're seeing in Gen Z. As a matter of fact, that is now the largest group in the country. They outnumber boomers, they outnumber Gen X, they outnumber millennials. That is the language that the largest demographic in our country is being raised on. If we want to communicate to them, we're going to have to figure out a way to become visual. And look, a book is not visual, a book is words. And so, of course, I've got lots of words in my books, but I'm trying to also marry those to visual illustrations.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with cold case homicide detective J. Warner Wallace. When it comes to engaging with highly educated secularists, skeptics, and flat-out atheists, no Christian desires to enter intellectual, philosophical, and theological engagements untrained. As a way of equipping you to stand faithfully and fruitfully for Jesus Christ and biblical truth, the Christian Research Institute is offering J. Warner Wallace's book, God's Crime Scene. A cold case detective examines the evidence for a divinely created universe. To receive your copy of God's Crime Scene as our thanks for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Equip.org. We'll be right back with more of this special edition of the Bible Answer Man. The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources, along with a complimentary subscription to the Christian Research Journal, are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. Because life and truth are under attack by secularists who deem the Bible nothing more than primitive superstitions and fairy tales, Christians are called to give reasons for what and why they believe to highly educated skeptics and atheists. Wisdom, however, warns against engaging in a defense of the one true faith without adequate training and preparation. The book by J. Warner Wallace, God's Crime Scene, A Cold Case Detective Examines the Evidence for a Divinely Created Universe, will equip you to present and defend the arguments and evidence for God's existence. To receive God's Crime Scene as our thanks for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or visit equip.org. Equip.org.
The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. Bring up religion or politics in a conversation, and often people stop being reasonable and demonize those who disagree with them. Fortunately, there are certain skills you can develop that will lead to civil discussions. Other topics include the historical uniqueness of Jesus Christ among the founders of the world's major religions, a practical guide to teaching students apologetics, understanding Nicene Trinitarianism, wrestling with God, church, and religion in the writings of Mark Twain, HBO's Westworld and the ethics of artificial intelligence, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.
let's rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and cold case homicide detective J. Warner Wallace in their conversation.
You know, I've often said that the issue of origins is not just an apologetic issue, it is the apologetic issue. How one views their origins ultimately is going to determine how they want to live their life. If you think you're a function of random chance that you arose from the primordial slime, you're going to live your life by a different standard than if you know you're created in the image of God and accountable to Him. And in that vein of thinking, I want to just talk about one of your books, God's Crime Scene, subtitled A Cold Case Detective Examines the Evidence for a Divinely Created Universe. What is a cold case detective?
Okay, so nationally, in our country, there's only one kind of crime that doesn't close after a set number of years. So if you do a robbery in our state, I'm sure it's true there for you as well, it depends on what kind of crime it is, if it's a robbery, a theft, if it's a burglary, or whatever kind of crime it is, all of these have a period after which they would close automatically by statute. It's 3, 5, 7 years, they're going to close. You cannot go back and prosecute somebody, you know, 15 years later for a robbery. That's got a statute of limitations, and it's already closed. Now, the only thing that doesn't have a statute of limitations are murders. So when we talk about cold cases, we're really only talking about one kind of crime. We're talking about unsolved murders, because there's no statute of limitations. Those stay open. They might be cold because no one's been able to find anything in years, but that's what I do is I come back and I say, well, what's changed in the last 35 years that might give me a way in? What has changed that might give me a strategy, kind of looking at it from 30,000 feet, that maybe wasn't available right away? You know, if you got 4 or 5 people who saw this thing and they were concerned about their safety because they were afraid this guy was going to hurt them, but now they're feeling pretty good about their safety, they might be willing to talk now when they weren't willing to talk before. So cold cases are simply unsolved murders.
And so you are solving the ultimate conundrum. I mean, is the universe created by an outside cause, by an uncaused first cause, or can the universe explain itself apart from an uncaused first cause?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, this little strategy I tried to illustrate in that book is one that I use at every death scene, because there's 4 ways to die, and not all those ways are criminal. You know, you've got natural deaths, accidental deaths, suicides. Those are not things I investigate. I only investigate it when it's finally been ruled to be a homicide. So I have to figure out when I first get there, is this a natural, an accidental, or a suicide? Because if it is, I'm out. I'm not going to be investigating that. We don't investigate those kind of things. So the question really is, how do I determine if the death scene is a crime scene? And the strategy we always use, and although I did this for probably, I don't know, 20 years before I started to think about it from 30,000 feet, is what we're trying to do here is we're saying, okay, can I explain everything that's in the room by staying in the room? If it's, there's a pistol next to the body, but that pistol is his pistol. He's only got one gunshot wound. It's his pistol, and there's a note next to his body written on his paper. I find it elsewhere in the room, and the doors are locked, and everything in the room comes back to him in terms of material evidence and DNA and fingerprints. Well, then I can explain everything in the room by staying in the room for an explanation. This is going to be an accidental or a suicide. But if I, on the other hand, have paper that's not his, and that's not his gun, it belongs to an unknown, and I have DNA and fingerprints that belong to an unknown who doesn't live there, and I even have footprints that lead out of the room, well, now the best explanation for the stuff that's in the room is a source that's outside the room. Everything now shifts toward homicide because we have good reason to believe we have an intruder. Well, I thought, couldn't this be applied to the universe? Can I explain everything that's in the room of the natural universe by staying in the room? If so, I've got to explain everything with just space, time, matter, and physics and chemistry. That's it. That's all that's available to me inside the room. But I think there's a bunch of stuff in the room that you can't explain on just the basis of space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry. The better explanation is a cause outside the natural realm that's not spatial, not temporal, not material, all-powerful. These are the things that we have to have in order to explain what's in the room. And so I think we've got good reason to believe there's an intruder. And that's why, for me, as an atheist, I started thinking, well, a couple of things. Number one, why am I holding on? At the very least, I have to be a deist. I mean, at the very least. And then I'm asking myself, why would I suspect that if there's a personal God who is the creator of everything in the universe from nothing, why am I getting hung up over these small miracles in the New Testament? I mean, those are small potatoes, right? I mean, walking on water, this is the God who created everything from nothing. And so for me, it opened up the door for me to rethinking my view toward naturalism and then my view toward miracles that I was encountering in the New Testament.
What's really interesting is I was reading or rereading just the other day for something that I'm writing, The Atheist's Guide to Reality. That, of course, was written by the vaunted R. Taylor Cole, professor of the philosophy department at Duke University, and he's just written another book basically saying that history is unreliable. But at any rate, he says in his book, 95% of the most distinguished scientists in America, along with, of course, their foreign associate members, they don't believe in God. And the other 5%, he says, simply swallowed the biggest conspiracy theory of them all, the story of how God put us here. And then he goes on to say something to the effect of science beats stories, stories about such things as meaning and purpose and free will and morality, stories we desperately need liberation from. And that seems to be a message that is not only catching on with his students at Duke, but with a whole variety of people around the world, but it has dramatic implications, because if you do not believe that there's a God, if you believe that there's no such thing as free will or morality or ethics or reliable history, you're going to live your life much, much differently than if you know there is a God and you're accountable to him.
I think you're spot on. Origins are the critical. Now I would have said as an atheist, and you probably would have too when you were in your 20s, okay, great, this is the story, but again, this doesn't mean, okay, because it's practical and useful and helping guide us in the future does not mean it's true. And my dad would say as an atheist today, he's fine with me embracing this fairy tale if it has that practical application, that practical use in my life. He would say, I've lived my entire life, he's 78, I've lived my entire life without any need for that sense of false purpose. Now, I will tell you this. It's funny to me that anyone would write a book, and having written this classic atheist guide, right? He wrote that at some point in the past. But if we can't trust history, I can't even trust that he wrote that, I guess, right? I mean, it seems like it'd be a self-defeating proposition, because we can't even trust our own past or the past of our families and our stories about how we got here. So I think we have to trust some history. The question is, which history claims do we trust, and on what basis do we trust those claims? So I think that approach is faulty to begin with. But I think you're right about this idea of story. It's not as though science is not without its stories. Every model offered by scientists to explain the universe or time, for example, the models that are offered, say, by Einstein, are really stories that help us to visualize the fabric of space-time. These are narratives that are parables, scientific parables of a sort, that help us to give us models, the same way I just provided for you this model of inside or outside the room. I'm telling a story about reality. Now, there are true stories, by the way. So the only question is, yeah, we all use stories. We all use stories to accomplish a goal, to explain something that's difficult to an audience that maybe is having a hard time putting their hands around it. The only question is the story I'm telling a true story or a false story? And do you have a tool set in place that allows you to distinguish between the two? Look, I get guys all the time who come to me in criminal investigations, and they'll offer me a story. I got to figure out, are they lying to me? And so I have a set of tools in place that help me to understand the deception indicators, to understand these things that help me to know if they're telling me the truth. And this is the same thing we have to do when studying any claim about the past. I have no problem with storytelling if what you mean by storytelling is a way to communicate a difficult truth using a parable that helps you put your hands around it. We all tell those kinds of stories.
You talked about being an atheist. There's a new play on that word atheism. It's called apatheism, the new apathy about God, which says his existence is not considered even a relevant question. How do you shake people out of their lethargy?
I think that apathy is a far greater danger, is a far bigger hazard. Apathy and overcoming apathy is a key to what we're going to have to face in the next generation with Gen Z. And I think there are some strategies for this. Look, no one's apathetic at a point of crisis. I don't have to worry about apathy in my victim families, for example. They are all passionately engaged in the process. They want to see justice. It turns out that apathy is that thing that is kind of milling around until the rubber meets the road. And what we have to do is show our young people where and how the rubber meets the road, where and how and why this is so critical. And a lot of that's going to come to them by way of narrative, by way of storytelling, by way of examples. And they love examples. They love storytelling. And so we're going to have to tell the stories that amplify for them why they should care. And they're probably going to be stories of tragedy, stories of crisis of meaning, a crisis of purpose. This is where all apathy vanishes. It vanishes when someone finally steals your car. It vanishes when someone finally, on the basis of a worldview that you don't agree with, does something to harm you. This is where apathy vanishes. And so I think that in the end, we have to kind of help ourselves. Also, let's face it, if we aren't modeling energy, passion, interest, if we are not clearly passionate about what we believe, then good luck trying to transfer that to the people you're working with.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. To hear this Hank Unplugged podcast interview with cold case homicide detective J. Warner Wallace in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. In appreciation for your gift to help strengthen and expand the life-changing outreaches of the Christian Research Institute, Hank would like to send you God's Crime Scene. A cold case detective examines the evidence for a divinely created universe by J. Warner Wallace. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. Cold case detective J. Warner Wallace would never allow a divine intruder to enter his life. Yet over time, something changed, and he now sees himself as a guest in the Creator's universe. Detective Wallace is not a theist because his parents believed or because he needed to fulfill a void in his life. Rather, he says, "I believe God exists because the evidence leaves me no reasonable alternative." God's Crime Scene. A cold case detective examines the evidence for a divinely created universe, presents the cosmological, biological, mental, and moral cases for God. To receive God's Crime Scene as our thanks for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org. Equip.org.